So there I was in Washington at a little cocktail party. I think there was only about 15, 20 of us, maybe 30 of us. And I think I caught Michael Kowalski muttering along the lines of, I hope my board of directors is okay with everything that we're doing, you know, because he was taking a very proactive position regarding gold mining. And then we were at this book signing, actually, this book called Branded. I keep seeming to be promoting a lot of books today, but this one, well, it's a lot of writing. The letters are kind of small. I think it's got something like 300 and something pages. And I've actually been reading it, every detail of it, actually. And what this book does is it's branded, How the Certification Revolution is Transforming Global Corporations. And they're not talking about GIA here. And they're not talking about IGI. And they're not talking, now it's very interesting that our industry, no problem certifying diamonds in color and clarity and cut. What is it? Shape, size, cut, color, clarity, you know, make, triple X's, triple VG's, XVG, VG, depth percentages, table percentages, no problem. How about a grade for ethics? How about a grade for, you know, this diamond is super kosher, sort of kosher, well, we don't even know because we're not looking kosher, or whatever. How about a grade for ethics of a diamond? We don't want to do that. I didn't want to talk about that. You know, now we'll just hide this book. But what's interesting about this book is that it tells the story. It tells the story of the timber industry, including pictures of very good-looking models from Victoria's Secret, apparently being shown as kind of evil devils. And it shows you, like, you know, movie stars establishing this idea of this the forestry council. And it talks about the timber industry, the fisheries industry, other industries have actually gone through the process that we're looking at possibly for the jewelry industry and what's important and how things work. And so that's a very a really good thing. And the author of this book, Michael Conroy, is with us here today. And he's going to talk about certification. I also want to point out that Michael is also the chairman of Fair Trade USA. I think that's a new name for transfer, right? Fair Trade USA, which is a fair trade organization. And they're starting to do gold. I think gold is getting certified already. And this idea, if you looked at something like evil, and then you said, well, how do we get rid of evil? And then you had, well, we're neutral. We're okay. There's a third step. We are like super great because the money from our products are creating sustainable economic development among the poorest people in the world. So there's evil, there's neutral, and then there's goody good stuff. And I think that it's very important to recognize the purchasing power that the jewelry industry has is so strong that we could rewrite the map in Africa where governments and developments and billions of dollars have not been able to control the situation. A good example of that would be in a place like Sierra Leone, where children, I think 26% of the children die by the age of 5. You can't legislate laws against smuggling or child minors when people are worried about what they're going to eat tonight. Who in this room wouldn't smuggle to keep your children alive? So at that level of where society isn't working, you really can't rely on government laws and you can't rely on things. But companies can come in and say, we will pay you a better price for your diamonds or your gold or your gems if, in fact, you apply certain standards. And I think what the Responsible Jewelry Council is doing could be very relevant if, in fact, they extended their standard system to incorporate where they buy diamonds from. And it's not just a local thing. My company's good, but I can source in evil places. But in any case, the conversation should transcend just looking at what's bad or shaming and blaming or documenting or whatever, to go to what can we do that's really good? And I think that that's one of the things that Michael's going to speak to us about. So I invite Michael Conroy to come up here, Michael. And I thank you very much for being here. And he's a very cool dude, good guy, all around good guy. And thank you very much for coming and being with us today, Michael. Good book, good book.
Thank you, Martin.
You have to sign that one.
Thank you very much. I was edging out of my seat and coming up here because I was afraid that Martin was going to give my whole talk before he let me start. But it gives me great pleasure to be here with you. And in a sense, it's a great way to end the afternoon workshop that we've had to begin talking about positive stories of solutions to ethical dilemmas. And the task that Martin has given me is try to convince you, representatives of the diamond industry, a real sense of the possibilities that exist for eliminating many of these ethically dubious or otherwise problematic products from your supply chains, from your product offerings, largely by illustrating what's happening in other important natural resource-based sectors. So briefly, what I want to do over the course of 25 or 30 minutes, and that actually illustrates a fundamental problem I've got. Peter Singer would agree with me that truth really only comes in two packages for us academics. There are 50-minute packages for Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and 75-minute packages on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And unfortunately, I've only got about 25 minutes, and so it's going to be a compacted version of truth that I bring to you. I want to talk about something that Roy has already brought to us. This was in my slide before I saw Roy Williams' presentation this morning, but he has set it up beautifully in terms of talking about how we have had historically great shifts in cultural values dominating society. And in fact, what I'm going to show you today is a very positive story coming out of the shift that he was talking about in the phase that we're in right now, of moving into and through a period where there's much more focus on responsibility, on the collective, on the community. And I'm hoping that it'll give us at least 12 more years to really wrap this up before the pendulum begins swimming back. I want to talk to you about the business dynamics of some of the certification systems that are written up in my book and that have been evolving ever since, and which my little consulting company is trying to promote. Give you some evidence of the successes to date in other sectors. Talk with you about some of the problems you have if you wanted to go out right now and say, as Peter Singer has encouraged you to do, let's rid our supply chains of these fundamentally ethically dubious products. It's very difficult to do, even with all the systems that mining of diamonds and of gold and silver and other metals tends to have. And then talk a little bit about what's emerging right now around ethical certification of diamonds. As Martin pointed out, you guys are very familiar with certification because you have all kinds of technical certifications associated with your industry. But what we're talking about here is voluntary ethical certification. Voluntary in the sense that it isn't required that you keep track of exactly what the characteristics are of the threads of a screw. It isn't required by law, but it has business value, and so it's being picked up by business. It is ethical in the sense that we're talking about that area of ethics where you as a company wouldn't necessarily have to do something, but because it has an impact on society outside the company and an impact on the environment or an impact on human rights, you ethically may need to do it. And the good news is I'm going to show you that you can do it and make it profitable, and to build it into the core of your business so that you're doing the right thing and benefiting from it at the same time. Now, what do you think all of these major businesses, brands, have in common? They may have lots of things in common, but one in particular that's relevant to our topic right now. You know, if this were a smaller room and I could see you better, I'd take hands, but the answer, to move through this quickly, is that every one of these brands has made its growth strategy significantly dependent upon a voluntary ethical certification system. We'll talk about Cadbury. We'll talk about Tiffany. We'll talk about Whole Foods. We'll talk about Home Depot in detail. But every one of these has publicly and formally made an ethical choice, a business choice, to use ethical screening on the products which it's bringing to consumers. Part of the motivation, part of the evidence of what Roy Williams was pointing out before lunch today, is that even in the middle of a great recession, the global recession, Time magazine found out last 2009, September 2009, we really are making different choices. Consumers, they found, and subsequent consumer surveys have documented it, as they cut back on their expenditures because of the crunch of unemployment, the crunch of lowered incomes, the crunch of problems from the financial crisis, they were actually turning to more responsible choices. These are a couple of the examples they listed that right now, in retrospect, seem to be fairly light. But there were many more examples given, and we have seen subsequently in consumer studies that people are turning more and more to thoughtful, responsible purchasing of products. Corporate response, again, reflecting what Roy was telling us, corporations are much more concerned with sustainability, much more concerned with the supply chains that are essential to sustainability. And we're not talking just about how can I be certain I'm going to get the materials that I need in a sustainable basis through time. No, we're talking about the ethical side of sustainability, which is concern for the globe, concern for the climate, concern for the environment, concern for the poor, under conditions where if the poor rise up, you may lose your sources, but also where you're taking an active ethical consideration of the poor. The important distinction that both of these reports came out with, the one from Accenture was in September of this year, the one behind it is from the World Business Council on Sustainable Development, which was July of this year. What they all suggested is that when we used to think of NGOs as those attack groups that are going to come out and make life lousy for us, NGOs are becoming increasingly partners in the delivering of sustainability, and we'll see a number of cases where it means partners in the delivery of an ethical solution to major dilemmas. Now, my book talks about a certification revolution, and I can summarize the book in one slide here so you don't have to buy it if you don't want. The first is that we've seen unparalleled changes. This is documented in so many different ways, including the last two reports that I showed you. The number of companies that do sustainability and social responsibility reports is skyrocketing. The changes in practices, the attention of companies is skyrocketing, in part because of this process that I call a three-legged stool, the intersection of three powerful forces. First of all, you have market campaigns, and I'll give you some illustrations of market campaigns in a minute. Secondly, you have the creation of third-party independent certification systems, generally nonprofit organizations, that set standards that give the advocacy NGOs something toward which they would like to move corporate practices. But the third leg of the stool, and you can't sit on a two-legged stool very well, the third leg of the stool is the internal champions within corporations. In every one of the really successful voluntary ethical certification systems that have evolved in the last 15 years, you can identify the key person inside the company, the key person inside the corporation who brought to the attention of the management and ushered through the company a commitment to do the ethically appropriate thing, because it could also show that it was a valuable thing to the corporation, to the company as a whole. What's made it even easier for them to push through is that we have had a booming market. We'll talk about fair trade products that are all over the world now in huge quantities that are no longer a niche market. We'll talk about sustainably harvested timber, sustainably harvested fish. Ethically certified products have booming markets that have continued to grow right through the global recession. So what's a market campaign? Well, you probably, but I hope it hasn't happened, you may have been subjected to one, although in the diamonds industry, up until now, there haven't been too many. Some of you who are in the jewelry industry will remember the No Dirty Gold campaign, and the No Dirty Gold campaign has led to another initiative that we'll talk about at the end that is creating the first global ethical standards for mining, so that the jewelry products can come somewhat freer of the ethical dilemmas that Peter and Annabelle were talking about. It focuses less on what we used to do, which was to boycott products and say we don't want to buy the product of that brand because that's a bad company. What we've learned is that the much more vulnerable point of entry, a point of leverage in corporations, is the brand. And the brand is not only now increasingly the largest part of the capitalized value of a company, it is also one of the most volatile and vulnerable. And I'll get into the details on that in a second. These campaigns, and I'll illustrate a couple in a minute, are driven in the highest moral terms. If they don't deal with truth, if they make accusations that cannot be substantiated and that the companies can easily deny and demonstrate, they're not effective. So there is a self-correcting mechanism around the moral values and the accuracy of the information that's brought forward. Obviously, the global revolution in communications has made these campaigns much more effective than they would have been 20 years ago, and has probably given them life far beyond what we expected 20 years ago. And in the end, they often lead to a situation where the advocacy NGO sits down and becomes the partner of the company in solving the ethical problems that that company has. Here's an example. An excerpt from a full-page ad in the Los Angeles Times about 5 years ago, showing on the one side, the screen is pretty distant from you, a child digging in a mining situation, and another where you're talking about cyanide damage in gold mines. Here's another one focused on college students at the time they're about to buy their graduation rings, challenging whether, if you don't know where the gold's coming from, if you don't know the conditions behind the production of that gold, the ethical conditions, is it so classy to buy one of those rings? Now, here's the one that Martin was referring to, one of my favorites. If you can't see it in the back, it says, Victoria's Dirty Secret. Some companies get a tree for the holidays. Victoria's Secret is taking a whole forest. It was basically a campaign by Forest Ethics and other NGOs to get Victoria's Secret, which at that time, 4 years ago, was sending out 400 million catalogs a year just within the United States, more than a million a day, and which refused to use recycled paper or paper that was certified as coming from well-managed forests. This particular ad, which ran in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and a couple of other papers, was originally crafted with a real chainsaw in the hands of the model. But in fact, the New York Times said, that's too terroristic. And so they put the stylized chainsaw, and some analysis of it by advertising and marketing people suggested it was even more impactful by doing it that way. The result was that within 2 years, Victoria's Secret has moved all of its catalogs to either recycled paper or FSC-certified paper, and a whole slew of other catalog companies are following suit. You can go home and, with the catalogs you receive, turn them over, and now about 30% of them will have a little logo that I'll show you in a minute, which is the logo of the Forest Stewardship Council. And it was this campaign which brought about that change in the catalog industry around paper. Now we get into the business case. My book was sent to the press in January 2007. And right after I sent it to the press, I got this Business Week magazine with this cover, which says, imagine a world in which socially responsible and eco-friendly practices actually boost a company's bottom line. It's closer than you think. And in the article, it talks about how it's here already in the certification systems for forest products, fisheries, agricultural commodities, that corporate accountability of this sort is right at the top of the agenda, and that the focus of the efforts of the watchdog groups was really moving it along, and brand value and shareholder value was what was most at risk. And I said, ugh, I've been scooped. Fortunately, the article was only 4 pages long, and my book is 320 pages long, and it's actually served to increase the demand for the book because the 4 pages that they had at that time has generated many other stories and a lot of attention. Now, I talked to probably 10 corporate boards a year, and over the last 6 or 7 years, I've done 50 or 60, all asking the question, what is this certification stuff about, especially voluntary, especially ethical certification? And this is the one slide where they begin to nod their heads and say, uh-huh, now we understand. We begin to see why it is that these systems are evolving and why they could be important to us. The first is to recognize that globally, branding is the name of the game. Of course, we're talking about positive branding. My book is called Branded, because it deals with the whole range of positive meanings from branding that you do to cattle, to the branding that's associated with a bad movie, to the branding that has the positive, evocative feel that marketers really want to generate. But as branding has become the leading edge of globalization, the more successful, the more you can recognize that Nike slash around the world, the more shoes they're going to sell. But there's an underside to that. Because the more successfully you get your brand out in front of people, the more you're the largest company around, the globalized company around, people are going to begin challenging you on the social and environmental characteristics of your supply chains, of the products that you're producing. And that's clearly part of what's happening now in terms of the recognition of human rights issues within the diamond industry, recognition of the environmental issues, recognition of other problems in a whole array of industries, as globalization is concentrating companies and as more and more attention is being paid to this. Now, certification systems, if you look at it theoretically, are nothing different from the other risk management processes that you use. Your company will have a fire insurance policy to manage risk of fires. You'll have director and officers insurance to protect against corruption. You'll have risk management for foreign exchange by doing hedging, forward hedging of foreign exchange. If you have a fear of reputational risk because of the social and environmental characteristic of your supply chain, it becomes a very important solution to engage in a certification system focused on that supply chain. Certification systems also reduce transactions costs. Economists love to talk about transactions costs, but there's a very simple example. If a retail jeweler, in order to protect itself from reputational risk, had to send a staff person out to every mine and every processing point and every polishing shop from which any of its diamonds came, imagine the costs involved in doing that. But if you have an organization, an agency, which is certifying most, if not all, of the supply chains that are bringing products to you, it will cost something, but it'll be significantly less than the cost of having to go out and check for yourself. Same is true for Home Depot trying to find out where the wood comes from. Same is true for Whole Foods trying to find out where the coffee and tea comes from. Certification systems are greatly reducing the costs of increasing your assurance about the supply chain that you're using. And the only credible certification in the 21st century is independent of the company by a third party who is neither a consultant to the company nor someone from the company itself. Ethical certification also brings these additional business benefits, and if you think about it, each one of them is potentially valuable to you. The most successful, as I'll show later, in certification systems are the ones that have the strongest backing from the world's most branded NGOs. So in the forestry sector, as we'll see, having Greenpeace and WWF and Natural Resources Defense Council and Friend of the Earth all favoring that particular certification system gives any company that declares a preference for FSC-certified products or that sells FSC-certified wood products an implicit co-branding. The umbrella of those NGOs covers that deal, covers that transaction in a way that actually protects you in a very real way. You could also have defensive ability on your reputation. No certification system is going to stop every potential little radical NGO from trying to attack you. But we've had many cases now over the last 10 years where when the attacks are inappropriate, when a company is certified, the NGOs that back the certification system will take out public advertisements supporting the company against the attack from the fringe NGO because they are participants in and have been certified under the particular certification system. Product differentiation, well, you all know what that's like in a downtime. You know how difficult it is in a recession to have to cut prices because it's brutal price competition on conventional products. But what if you're the first one on your block to bring in a differentiated product that has an ethical quality that your competitors don't actually have? Product differentiation has become a very major source for the introduction of ethically certified products in many industries around the world. And then there are other tangible financial benefits that come from, you know, Home Depot, which was the first major do-it-yourself company in the United States to declare a preference for FSC-certified wood products, over the first 5 years had a 10% reduction in its labor force turnover because the employees were so proud of working for the lead company in terms of those environmental characteristics. Sometimes there's a price premium. Almost always there's differential access to markets when you've got an ethically differentiated product to offer. So many of you will be saying, nobody's walking in my door asking for it. My clients aren't coming in and saying, where's the ethical diamond? And what we have to do is look at the interplay here of business to business and business to consumers. First of all, in almost all of the existing and successful systems, the initial uptake was strictly B2B. It was Home Depot not responding to challenges from consumers saying, where is the FSC wood? It was Home Depot making a decision that it wanted to stop the challenges to its purchasing power, purchasing policies from certain NGOs, but also it wanted to assure its board that it wasn't buying illegal wood or wood that was coming from old growth forests that needed to be conserved. Companies will generate ultimately that business to consumer because they want to advertise their differentiated products. So you do it with point-of-sale materials. You do by advertising you're the first one in the city to have fair trade certified plums or whatever the product might be. And your NGO supporters under the certification system will also contribute to the marketing of the product and generate more pull from consumers. In the forestry sector, this took about 10 years. In the fishery sector, it's taken about 7 years. Fair trade is taking off in about 5 years. And there are new systems coming in right now, which probably will only take 2 or 3 years to go from initial B2B decisions and widespread and very effective markets for those ethically certified products. Now, let's just go through very, very quickly some examples of successful certifications in other natural resource sectors. This is the symbol of the Forest Stewardship Council. It now has about 15% of all the world's working forests certified under its standards, and it only has been functioning for about 14 years. It's continuing to grow very rapidly. It's, in a sense, winning the battle between substitute systems that the industry is trying to create that solve fewer ethical problems and give fewer benefits in terms of the sale of the product to consumers. It's the only one that has very significant social and dimensions, human rights dimensions, local community dimensions, indigenous peoples dimensions, and that's given it great value over competing systems. And there are now more than 40,000. By the time I finished this, I heard it was 45,000 documented products around the world being sold with an FSC logo of the same sort as that on the product, with a very significant total estimated retail global value. It's worldwide. It's in 82 countries. It has consistent standards. It's continuing to grow in almost all of those countries. And it's continuing to grow in part because we're getting, and I'm going to go back here and then see if I can move this backwards. These are the leading NGOs that all support only the FSC system and not any of its competitors, which are the industry-led systems. The pull through the system comes from companies like Kimberly-Clark, world's largest producer of tissue products, who has now committed to getting all of its products certified under one system or another, but with a clear preference for the Forest Stewardship Council, and that by 2011 it'll have 40%. You're soon going to see, because it's just being rolled out, the FSC logo on many of these products, beginning with Kleenex and Cottonelle toilet paper and Scott products. And that means that Kimberly-Clark is fulfilling its commitment to source only from thoroughly recycled or FSC-certified fiber. Here's another natural resource industry, the Marine Stewardship Council. That's the label that you will find, especially in Whole Foods stores, but increasingly in many others, especially in Europe. It now covers 70% of all the world's ocean-caught salmon, 26% of whitefish. Whitefish is the fish that goes into fish sticks and McDonald's fish sandwiches and a variety of other low-price focused products. And Walmart is the one who's, in a sense, driving them to even higher levels. There are 40 to 50 fisheries now certified, and the Marine Stewardship Council hasn't got enough staff, can't hire enough staff to certify enough fisheries to meet the demand created just by Walmart and its competitors around making certain that fisheries become sustainable rapidly, so we no longer face what many have been describing as the empty oceans. In other sectors, certified fair trade is going to top more than $6 billion. 10 years ago, it was mostly church basement stuff. Now it's in 40,000 stores in the United States. It is in the Whole Foods stores. They have 1,500 different fair trade certified products throughout their system. Global retail sales growing very rapidly. Coffee is the biggest product in fair trade, and coffee is coming close to having a quarter of all the coffee in the world certified by 2015, according to a study by the World Trade Organization. This is not niche stuff anymore. Fair Trade and Association for Responsible Mining Gold will reach markets this fall. Complicated process, focuses primarily on artisanal miners, and that's where it matches with Fair Trade, which works primarily with small-scale producers. Here's one example that I just want to run through for the final line here. Cadbury converted all of the chocolate going into its Dairy Milk Bar. Dairy Milk Bar, for those of you from Europe, you'll know, it's the European equivalent of a Hershey bar in this country, except it tastes a lot better. They committed in February to turn all of it into fair trade certified. Last February, BBC's Panorama program, which was like their 60 Minutes program, ran an expose on child labor in cocoa growing in Ghana, including a story that says they had found children working on one of the farms that supplies Cadbury. And their intention was to pillory Cadbury as an example of major industries associated with child slavery on cocoa farms. It turns out that the farm from which they were purchasing had been fair trade certified, but just before the BBC crews got to the farm, the cooperative had been suspended under fair trade rules because the inspections done by fair trade had discovered some evidence of child labor and potentially child slavery in that co-op. And so by the time the article, by the time the show came out, they had to admit that Cadbury was ahead of the field because it had gotten all of its cocoa sources fair trade certified, that it had been discovered by the fair trade certifier, and that it was being remedied. And so they gave fair trade as a major potential solution to the ethical dilemma in the cocoa trade, and Cadbury really got off a lot easier than any other company would have if it hadn't been certified in this way. So what is it that seems to make the most important things in terms of making these systems successful? The first is, we're not talking about an NGO coming along and imposing standards on you. We're not talking about a group simply saying, this is the way you got to do it, or you don't get our label. The most successful systems have been stakeholder-based and negotiated. So the standards get negotiated, the governance system gets negotiated, industry and NGOs and communities affected all participate. The second is that you create truly independent auditing and verification systems for compliance with the standards, and a dispute response system, dispute resolution system, such that anyone who has a complaint can bring that complaint forward, and there is a way of efficiently dealing with those complaints. All these systems have some traceability. So we're talking about Marenge diamonds out of Zimbabwe going into India. If we had a full-fledged fair trade diamond or sustainable diamond or ethical diamond system in place, and it doesn't exist yet, you would have to have full traceability for those diamonds through the entire process. And that's the way you solve the problem of saying, well, if I'm going to buy from this particular dealer, how can I be absolutely certain that they're not coming from Merengue, that they're coming from other sources? And they would have to be able to provide the traceability, minimally through the sort of double audit process where you keep track of them as they're moving through the system, but also sometimes in other ways of doing that auditing. But traceability is absolutely essential to credibility for these kinds of systems. Reasonable stability is really important. From a business perspective, you don't want to work with a certification system that says this month, this is the way it's got to be, guys. Oops, we found something else over here. We want to do it this way. No, no, it's got to be done this other way. That kind of instability will drive any of you crazy. And the systems that are most successful have stability, not permanently. Maybe you set a set of standards in the negotiated fashion for 3 years. 4 years. And then you come back and revise them, but you do all your revisions in one bunch of revisions rather than having to have the rules continuously changing over time. And in the end, people are talking about, is this just a B2B process? Can I get away with just that? If you want to have a price premium on your product, you've got to have a logo that's consumer facing. As we go through some of the assurance systems in the mining industry right now, you're going to see that many of them fall short of being able to produce a full-fledged, premium-generating ethical certification system because they don't get to the point of a traceable product from a specific site with a recognizable logo attached to it. So what are some of the systems that are actually used right now? Most of you, those of you who are closer to the mining industry would know much of this, those of you in the processing industry. But this is pretty much the dominant processes inside of diamond mining. And we'll just go through them one after another. Annabelle suggested that I was going to kind of fix the Kimberley process. I'm not sure the Kimberley process is fixable, although the Diamond Development Initiative is certainly trying to do that. There are no social or environmental requirements. It's only focused on conflict-free origin. And whether or not it contains human rights dimensions that are actually measurable is pretty much dispelled by the decision around Zimbabwe, I believe. So I'm going to argue that it has no real assurance about human rights conditions. It's a slow process. It's an intergovernmental process. It's not a company-driven process. It's not an NGO-driven process. And as we saw in the case of Zimbabwe, the decisions are international political decisions, not really ethical decisions. Do our international political agencies sometimes make unethical decisions? Absolutely. There's no question about that. There's much more evidence coming out that it's pretty easily evaded, not just with the transfer of diamonds across country borders, but in terms of the packaging, in terms of the labeling, in terms of the full traceability of the supply chain. So I don't think Kimberley is going to help you very much, although it's a very important process to begin to reduce what we had much more extensively in the past, and as Annabelle pointed out, still in some cases, diamonds coming out of conflict zones and contributing to the generation of more conflicts. ICMM, International Council of Mining and Minerals, they've got sort of a light set of standards. They have no real independent third-party certification to those standards. We don't have verification at the levels that you'd need in order to be fully certain on an ethical basis of the sourcing of a particular product. And there's been no NGO involvement, so there is no NGO support. You don't get the NGO co-branding. You don't get any NGO nonprofit organization support for you're using that particular system. Global Reporting Initiative, created by NGOs, a marvelous system. But all it does is it certifies that you're reporting certain things. You're reporting the cubic meters of water used in your mine. You're not reporting what's the toxic release inventory in the water that you're putting back into the river. You're not reporting the social problems that are being created in your particular mine. You are going to report that, yes, we have this many people, this is the training that they have received, and so forth, but it isn't something which gives you the value that you need for a true ethical certification system. It doesn't have standards for social or environmental performance, as opposed to what did you do, it's not what happened on the ground, what was actually happening on the ground, because they don't ask that. ISO certifications, I'm going to move through this quickly because they're management system certifications. They're not performance-based certifications. So once again, they're not going to be able to tell you. They will tell you that one of your suppliers has a system that says, we will not do anything unethical. And this is the way we're going to see whether we do anything unethical. But it doesn't have a check on it and a verification that it's not actually engaging in unethical projects. The Responsible Jewelry Council, which has been mentioned a couple of times right now, is an effort moving in the direction of a valid, valuable, ethical certification system. I think, however, and I was with the Standards Committee chairman yesterday in a meeting in San Francisco, and he agrees with me that it is primarily focused on companies and the standards that the companies use. There has been little NGO engagement. It has beginning to get some chain of custody, but it's not chain of custody product specific, back to the site of the production where you can look at the ethical characteristics of the production. So if there's no site-specific traceability, no verification of compliance with standards linked to a particular product. It will help the industry keep better track of what its sourcing is. It'll help the industry establish a uniform set of standards, but it's not going to be very helpful to you to actually get a product-specific assurance that it is an ethically clean, human rights clean system, and there's no consumer-facing label. So, three slides of other projects underway, and then I'm finished. We already had, Annabelle suggested the Diamond Development Initiative. It came out of the Kimberley process. It is working on a variety of issues. I actually think I have much of the same quote that she used. I congratulate Martin for his continued struggle to bring something called fair trade diamonds out. I appreciate his definition of what they could be. I, for one, know how much Martin has been pressuring all of us to get him a certification system. At times, he's been willing to say, find me monitors, and I'll sit him on a hilltop over the mine so I can be sure that things are being done the right way. And as you'll see with a couple of the evolving systems right now, he hasn't been able to find a way to certify the fair trade diamonds that he's trying to promote within the industry. Fairtrade USA had a diamond feasibility exploration a year and a half ago. It was initiated with a very nice grant from the Tiffany & Company Foundation. We have a full feasibility study that if any of you are interested in, we can supply to you of the potential for certification of diamond mining sites. We have a partial feasibility study on chain of custody mechanisms that could be done. It's on hold right now because to go forward, we need two things. We need an indication from the industry that you would really like to see something like this happen. And we haven't had that from many companies other than Martin's and Michael Kowalski's. But we also need a small amount. You know, we're talking about creating a system like this and running it is only going to cost a few $100,000. For the industry as a whole, it's a very small amount of money. But try to find that money and try to put together a partnership of companies who are willing to stand behind it. We've had difficulty moving it forward for that reason as well. One more is the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance that Annabelle also mentioned. It's called IRMA. I spent the last 2 days in San Francisco with the latest face-to-face meeting of its steering group that has top leaders of the mining industry, top leaders of the NGO world, labor leaders, indigenous peoples leaders, all coming together on a set of 12 complex standards that they would like to launch fairly soon, covering most of the areas that we've been talking about right now. This is the most comprehensive one. They're talking about picking commodities to start with, like gold and diamonds and possibly platinum. They have a lot of interest in the industry and potentially expanding it into copper and nickel. It should be completed relatively soon, but again, it's slow because there isn't a staff that's working on it continually. The resources aren't there to move it more rapidly to fruition. But if the diamond industry was interested in participating more, talk to me after our session today, and I can connect you to the people with whom you could engage to move this forward, and to move it forward specifically and more rapidly in diamonds, if you were interested. It is, for my money, the one which is most likely to produce a truly valuable, globally relevant certification system for mining of all scales that will deal directly with the ethical issues, the human rights issues, the environmental issues that we're talking about today. So, three points of summary. I think that there are significant reputational risks for the industry out there. The gold industry responded by helping to create this IRMA process because there was a No Dirty Gold campaign raised, and there was a fear in the industry that among consumers, gold would lose its luster, to coin a phrase, lose its luster as a store of value and as a basis for something which carries with it the branding of love and commitment and all the other values of gold. There hasn't been a campaign against the diamonds industry yet. I think that as we're more and more aware of the magnitude of the human rights problems, the weakness of the Kimberley process, it is more likely that one or another of the NGOs would begin a campaign against the diamond industries and potentially undermine the value of diamonds and the way that you want to sell diamonds. And the best defense that you're going to have is to create a truly complete negotiated stakeholder-based system to rid the system, or at least give you the ability to identify the products that have ethical dilemmas embodied within them. Significant potential benefits, I believe, for the industry from that. And I think in the end, again, you're the ones who have to decide that you really want it as an industry, put a little bit of resources and some people power behind it, and it could be done in a year or two, so that you could come to a meeting in 2 years from now and have the confidence that the ethical dilemmas that Peter and Annabelle have been talking about have been significantly reduced in your supply chains. Thank you very much.